Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Time for KER Politics, starting out with Chris Temple. We may go on with Chris. It's hard to say at this point in time. The guy is so bright that I can't just say, hey, Chris, you've only got one segment. So we'll talk about something else possibly. But having said that, to start out with, you know, Chris sent me an email that really made a lot of sense. He sent it back on February 4th, and he said, Al, lots of things to say about things like the 70% income tax proposal, and now a proposed bill to limit corporations on stock buybacks until they raise wages, take care of workers, etc. After telling us for so long, you can't legislate. Now the left wants to do so. Chris, you make a great point. Let's talk about that.
Well, you can't legislate morality. And look, I want people as their homework assignment for this weekend, Al, to go to my website, nationalinvestor.com. Click on the commentary section and you'll find a story that I wrote. It's a little bit dated, but it's just as relevant today. The title is Real American Heroes, and it's of one of the heroes of my life, though he was dead before I ever was born, a man named George F. Johnson, who was the founder of the Endicott Johnson Shoe Corporation in upstate New York, where I'm from. And that was the epitome of how a corporation treats its workers. In the Depression, he laid off nobody. Everybody got their hours cut modestly. Everybody pulled together. His laborers signed a loyalty oath, in fact, that they would not allow communist agitators, which you had in those days, to come in and unionize Endicott Johnson workers. They didn't need it. They already had a square deal from their boss before Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama were a gleam in their father's eyes. George F. Johnson gave all of his employees and their families cradle-to-grave health care. They didn't lobby for it. They didn't have to go on strike for it. He gave it to them because he followed the biblical principle that when you have employees, you treat them as if they were your family because, by extension, they are. Now, we have had people for years tell us that you can't legislate morality. They have de-Christianized the United States of America, and they wonder why, when by default we now have a money standard and money is the God, the almighty dollar, sure, and not God himself, they wonder why you have the stratification of wealth. They wonder why trickle-down economics doesn't work. And what the Ocasio-Cortezes and the Bernie Sanders of the world need to go back to the drawing board on, Al, among other things, is to question, should we have eradicated Christian values and a more homogeneous, cohesive culture from our country? Because when we got rid of that, guess what? We got rid of any social construct that was there that would lead to the kind of thing they're talking about now having to do by coercion and by legislation, because people don't know that they can or should do this themselves.
You know, I got to tell you, it's Jay Taylor and I had numerous conversations on this subject over 10 years ago. Having said that, the decline of moral values in the United States, Chris, are just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I'm looking forward to, Chris and I, by the way, are going to be doing a special edition. We're going to be watching, obviously, the State of the Union address, and then we are going to immediately put it up, put our comments up afterwards, our opinions. But you can't tell me that the United States is on a positive moral course right now. I just simply cannot believe what's going on. And, you know, you look at somebody like Mr. Endicott, that, in my opinion, is what capitalism should be all about, and not just the stuff that's going on right now. I really, because of what's going on right now, I have to tell you, as one of my kids said on New Year's Eve a couple of years ago, I fear for our country, and I really do. I want to talk about the other subject you were talking about, though, Chris, and that has to do with limiting stock buybacks until a company raises wages, takes care of workers, etc. Takes care of workers is a pretty, pretty open-ended, nebulous concept. What do you think?
Nebulous is an understatement.
It's exactly,
and it shows that the people who are proposing this, they're playing just to crass, ignorant class warfare. They have no idea why they're proposing this, except that they think it's going to get them votes from the people who are just angry that somebody has more than they do. At no point in the proposals, whether it's from Senator Sanders or Chuck Schumer is on board or Elizabeth Warren or any of these other people, they don't even, in my opinion, morally, to a fair extent, they're taking the right position. Legally, constitutionally, economically, they have utterly no idea what they're talking about.
I agree.
Now, Bernie Sanders, and I've said this in the past, I met him years ago when he was still in the House. Good guy. He's a sincere guy in what he says. He sincerely believes in the things that come out of his mouth. Unlike Chuck Schumer, unlike some of the Democrat Party leadership, I believe Bernie Sanders does. But here's a guy who, for all the different proposals he's making, that now Elizabeth Warren is mimicking them, or this Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is mimicking them. Tell me about social credit. Tell me how you're going to pay for this stuff. Because there is a way that they can get what they want, but they have to be able to say these things and propose these things based on two foundational principles that they run away from. Number one is you have to have a Christian social consciousness and culture. They've said we can't have that. We're going to be a secular country now. Okay, well then don't complain when people won't voluntarily, you know, share the wealth, so to speak. The other thing is, when have any of these people ever come out and
said,
Chris,
I want to stop you just for a second. You made a point that I think is worth discussing, and we have a little bit of free time here. We've got about a 2-minute, maybe 3-minute or so window here before we have to wrap this segment up, and that is I think the problem with the progressives is it is all about secularism. I really do. And moral values simply don't fit into that picture. And, you know, and I think that Bernie Sanders probably, I agree with you, I think his heart's probably in the right place, but I think he's just, you have to have Judeo-Christian moral values, in my opinion.
Well, I think you do need that, but you also need to have an understanding of economics and money. And for as long as we have a privately owned fractional reserve banking system run by the Fed in the way that it operates, it by its very nature is the antithesis of the kind of money system that would foster Christian economics, that would foster everybody in society sharing the wealth. By its nature, the money system that we have leads to the kind of stratification of wealth and the haves and the have-nots that we have today. That is part of the animal. Yep. And until these people attack that and say, we need to abolish the Fed, we need a system of social credit, we cannot have man is the servant of money. We need to come up with a money system that serves man. Until they do that, all this pie-in-the-sky Marxist claptrap is worthless.
Well, it is worthless, Chris. There's no question about that. I really have to, we bring up an interesting subject, and I'm happy to go into this another segment on this one, but we don't have to also. You look at the real agitators today. Alexandria has invited a real active feminist agitator to be her guest at the speech tonight. It'll be interesting to see if that woman does anything, State of the Union, I should say. What I have to ask you, Chris, and we got to take a real quick break here. Let's just come back for about 8 minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, stick around. One more interesting question. Mr. T and I will be right back.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing, This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Okay, welcome back. You know, the old time clock caught me unawares. You know, what I want to talk about, Chris, is we've talked about morals at your suggestion, and I agree with you what you're saying 100%, but I want to talk about what's behind the morals, and that's called motive. Now, you look at some of the real interesting things that are going on in our country right now, the change in the abortion law that was approved by the governor of New York. I mean, that is not even close to being an action of any moral value whatsoever. It's closer to being criminal. It's closer to being murder, in my opinion. And then we have another federal representative, I believe he's a congressman, who has said children should not be protected just because they are born from death. And what he means by that is, basically speaking, and I couldn't believe this, he said, you know, if it doesn't work for the parents, whatever, even after the infant is born, the child should be able to be killed. I can't believe that. That's happening in my country, Chris.
Well, look, that's one of numerous examples. We talked about the economic aspect of this and the social construct economically, but it's one of many ways in which the U.S. has been de-Christianized. Mm-hmm. We do not have a moral grounding in this country anymore. We do not expect when people from other faiths and cultures come here that they will assimilate like my grandparents did and their parents before them, etc. Of all things, now we're supposedly going to have, and we're recording this just before, not only a Democrat response but a Spanish language response to the State of the Union. I mean, are you kidding me? This is silliness. But everything has been done to destroy the culture and social and religious fabric of this country. And this is the consequence of it. And, you know, I was talking in the last segment, Al, about how the left, for lack of a better way to put it, has, you know, they can't understand why the corporations and big business and the big banks and everything don't behave as Christians. So now instead of replacing what's going on today with Christianity, they want to replace it with Karl Marx. Well, let me turn the tables for some of my conservative Christian friends. You were the ones who were too afraid to defend Christianity as the faith of the United States of America. You don't want to be called intolerant. You don't want to be called names. And yet you complain that there's not prayer in school. You complain when people want to take So help me God out of the oath for members of Congress. Well, you yourselves wouldn't stand up for your Christian country, so don't complain and carp and bitch when you don't have any special favor for Christianity. And I speak, of course, in general terms, as the framers of this country did. So here again, it's not just the left. It's the people on the right who are double-minded. And like the Bible says, a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. The left can't understand why you don't have Christian principles and how money is shared and how the economy runs when they don't want Christianity. And the people on the right claim they want Christianity, but they've never defended it. Yeah. When you get right down to it, and they don't have what they want either.
No, a lot of people are afraid to. By the way, the comment I made about the politician who endorsed, for lack of better terms, euthanasia, I fact-checked that, Chris, while you were talking. That was an error on my part, and look at I could not find that as being a fact. And having said that, I have to retract totally that statement. But that doesn't take away what they're talking about. What has been approved in New York, by the way, you know, virtually almost up to term. I mean, that is absolutely crazy. But you know, it flips over into our the moral value of what we're talking about, the moral aspect, Chris. About we're talking what you and I are talking about right now flips right over into dishonest money. Fiat currency, as you and I have talked about ad nauseum in all of the years that we've known each other, fiat currency is dishonest money. It's money backed by psychological aspects of human nature, and you can't do that if something is going to be utilized as a medium of exchange. It has to have an honest, measurable value to it.
Well, it needs to have that, Al, or it needs to be honest, period. I have long said that the answer to our monetary issues is not that you've got to bring back gold, for example, to back the U.S. dollar. Number one, today, it's a physical and practical impossibility. Number two, we had a gold-backed dollar for the first chunk of the Federal Reserve's life. It didn't do anybody a hell of a lot of good. You have to have, instead of that, a currency that is not run and controlled by any private entity. You need to have, and folks, look this up. You know, get your head out of your rear ends with these gold bug yahoos that are out there to telling you that gold is the cures to everything that is, you know, besetting mankind. It's not. You need to look up social credit. You need to look up barter. You need to look up community currencies. The problem with this dollar that we have today is not that it's not backed by gold. It is that it is issued at interest by a private bank. If you had social credit, and the last guy that came close to trying to do anything of that nature was John F. Kennedy. We know where that got him. If you had legitimate social credit, you could have, not that I agree with these things and that that's still this simple of an answer, folks, don't get me wrong. Then, with social credit, the things that the Sanders and the Ocasio-Cortezes, the Elizabeth Warrens, and frankly some populists on the so-called political right, now some of these things that take care of people rather than the powerful become possible. Yep. But with a Federal Reserve system, it's only the powerful that is served. It's only money that is served.
I can't really disagree with that. That's why the Federal Reserve is called the creature from Jekyll Island. Big creature, yeah. A lot of bad gators down there around Jekyll Island. By the way, the one comment I want to make is that I'm on a real bandwagon right now for discussing the lack of moral values in the United States and how I feel that's permeating into our very society, which by the nature of the subject, of course, it would. But, you know, back to the point that I made when we started this segment, Chris, and that is, what is the bottom line motive of the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes of this world? And there are a lot of them out there. Thank God there aren't really that many of them out there, but they're hurting the Democratic Party. There's no question about that. And that's something we're going to talk about in the coming weeks, obviously. But what is their real motive? Is it selfish? You've only got about 25 seconds to say yes or no, Chris.
Well, you know, I think with some of the politicians, they are rebelling against the system they know is flawed. They know it's evil. They know it benefits the wealthy. They unfortunately, number one, don't have enough historical and technical knowledge and practical knowledge to know really the root cause of the problem, number one, and number two, how to fix it. And unfortunately, their strings are pulled in some cases by people who have got a much bigger agenda to simply want to sow discord and use their ignorance to do it.
I would agree. We'll learn this subject later. Words of wisdom from Chris Temple.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome and continuing in with KER Economics, economic politics actually right now. I'm chatting right now with a new guest, Ivan Penchikov. Ivan is a reporter for the Epoch Times. And you all know what I think of the Epoch Times. It's the only hard copy newspaper that I read practically on a daily basis. Whenever I get it, I have a subscription. Whenever I get it, I do read it. Why do I read it? I read it purely and simply because the Epoch Times is the only paper, in my opinion, that's old-fashioned in the sense that they talk about the truth. We're going to get into that a little bit later, but, you know, if you ever want a trial subscription or whatever to the Epoch Times, we've got about 400 of you who are pretty active on our blog. Just let me know, and I'll make sure that you get, you know, a trial copy or what have you. It is an excellent, excellent newspaper. Ivan, the first thing I'd like to ask you is, you are now with the Epoc Times. I've never met you in person, but then again, I've never met Josh or Charlotte in person, and I love them both. Having said that, give us a little bit about your background, if you would, Ivan.
Thank you for the great introduction of the newspaper, first of all. As some can probably tell by my name, I'm from Russia originally. I've been in the United States since 1999, 2000. I joined the Epoc Times back in 2010, full-time 2011. I started as a local reporter, so I covered City Hall during the tenure of Mayor Michael Bloomberg and then Mayor de Blasio, and then moved on to covering national issues. I write a lot about the White House and D.C. politics on a daily basis. And since President Trump took office, I've been writing about the various investigations that popped up starting right after the election and have been going on to this day.
Well, you know, as Trump mentioned...
I live in...
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
I thought I'd add, I live in New York, happily married, and that's the only place I've lived since coming to the United States. I feel like I'm a true New Yorker and an American on top of that. I've got a citizenship, so I consider myself an American who happened to have been born in Russia.
Well, you know, my parents certainly fell into that category. They very definitely considered themselves to be Americans. My dad was in the Coast Guard during the Second World War. He was also employed in a defense industry, and I have to say, you know, the guy in my family, for what it's worth, who was really pro-American from a conservative standpoint, was my grandfather, who was at the time of the revolution, he was a high-ranking officer in the Imperial Russian Navy. And once he came over to the U.S., he said, you know what, there is no country like the United States in terms of opportunity. So I grew up with that mantra, you know, from day one, for lack of better terms. Tell me a little bit about your education. You don't just get a job as a reporter because you're, you know, a dunderhead, for lack of better terms.
Well, you'd be surprised, but I think as far as the statistics go, most of the people who go into journalism actually didn't go to journalism school, or at least most of the really good ones. But myself, I did study English in New York City at City University of New York.
Yeah.
Public university, part of the public system. I focused more on literature and on teaching. I wanted to become a teacher when I went to school, but that ultimately didn't work out. So I actually did. I worked for the city government for a couple of years. Then I worked for an export trading company for a couple of years. I ran a small business with my parents in New York City, a retail business selling Russian food here.
Russian food? I'm sorry, Russian food?
That's right, Russian food.
My two favorite dishes in the world, bar none, would be pelmeni and pirozhki. And I don't mind golubtsy either. I mean, I love them. I grew up on that stuff, man.
Yeah, same here.
You know, the thing I like about you and your colleagues at the Epoc Times is you guys remind me by your actions an awful lot of myself when I was your age, which is a number of years ago. You've got a real passion for what you do. You've got a real passion for moral values and the truth. And I have to tell you, because of that, I have a real passion for the Epoc Times. Having said that, let's talk a little bit about you. The last article that you wrote, which was a couple of weeks ago, that I really focused on was some of the information that the FBI withheld from the government. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, the story itself is nothing new. Most people have been reading about Hillary Clinton's emails for a long time now, 2015, 2016, this story started. But the details of what actually happened really started coming out last year with the Inspector General's report and with the public testimony by the officials involved. And what's happened over the course of 2017, 2018 is that a lot of the testimony that was given to the House, joint House Judiciary and Government Oversight Committees, remained confidential. So we did not know about the details of what went in, down in those interviews, what was said. And those two committees concluded their investigation at end of 2018. The conclusions sounded mostly watered down. We didn't get to learn a whole lot from what they learned from all these interviews. But the Epoch Times received from a source the transcripts of some of these testimonies. And the issue I pursued specifically, this is a story that was first spoken about mid last year, and that is that the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, the government agency basically that initiated the whole Clinton email investigation, when they referred initially the lead to the FBI, there was an initial meeting where information was disclosed, but then they kept on going back to the FBI to give them more referrals about this case. And one of these referrals, based on what I've learned from the transcripts, was that the Inspector General has discovered that the metadata of virtually every email that Clinton email that Hillary Clinton sent was indicating that a copy of the email was sent to a foreign third party. Now, we knew about the referral from public testimonies last year, but we didn't know what the FBI did about it, and we didn't learn anything about it from the Department of Justice Inspector General's report, which is like several hundred pages that came out last year. And even when the Inspector General was questioned about this last year, he didn't know what the FBI did with the referral. So what I wanted to pursue is to see what each of the witnesses said, each of the FBI witnesses said about what they did with the referral. And what I discovered is that nobody knew about it. So it was a very specific referral that the FBI received, and all the key people who should have known about it knew nothing about it. And some of the key players were totally baffled that such information existed.
Mr. Penchikoff, got to take a real quick break here. I apologize for that. As you know, we will be on the air with this here in less than 24 hours. And I have to say that our stations do need to take quick commercial breaks. That's what's happening right now. I'm going to be right back, you guys, with Ivan Penchikoff. Hey, welcome back. Here to wrap up KER Politics. I'm talking with a new friend of mine, Ivan Penchikoff. Ivan is a reporter with the Epoch Times, along with my friends Charlotte Cuthbertson, Joshua Philip, and certainly Valentin Schmidt. Joshua was talking about something that I find to be fascinating because I read just recently, earlier this week, that Hillary Clinton will be required to testify on the subject that we're discussing. Can you finish your story real quick, Ivan?
Sure. So we left off at the key people at the FBI knowing nothing about this alarming referral that every one of Hillary Clinton's emails was going to a foreign third party. By some accounts, anonymous accounts that the Daily Caller and Fox News reported on, every email was going to a Chinese company in the Washington, D.C. area. And the president actually tweeted about that last year as well. So what I've discovered is the key people knew nothing about this referral, which appears to suggest a few storylines. And of course, I don't have the proof to say which one is right, but one possibility may be that when this referral was passed on to the FBI, and a small group, it was passed on to four people at the FBI, that one or more of them decided to internally suppress that part of the referral. And as a result, we now are hearing from all these people that they knew nothing about it. And the pattern that happened during the investigation is that the people who started on the probe, and then, you know, Peter Stroke and people above him in the chain of command, were all replaced during the course of the year long basically investigation. So, people who started it and who have received that referral were all gradually replaced during the investigation. And when it wrapped up, it was an entirely new team. With the exception being literally, as far as management goes, two or three people, Peter Stroke, Jonathan Maffa, and James Comey.
Yeah.
So there's some odd things going on that would suggest that this could have been repressed or ignored by a handful of people.
You know, it's funny, Ivan, but before the election, when Trump was elected, my question to listeners, not my question, but my statement to listeners, kind of the overall statement that I made on this show, was we're going to see in this coming election, I don't mean 2020, but I mean the 2016, just exactly how much the American people have to say about choosing their leaders and just how strong the Clinton family really is. While the results of the November 2016 election proved that they weren't as strong as they thought they would, but you know, this thing is still dragging out and dragging out and dragging out to the point where we almost have a civil war in the, not necessarily a physical civil war quite yet, but we have almost a political civil war in the United States right now. And I would say the Clinton family is probably, you know, when the dust settles, for lack of better terms, I would think that the Clinton family is going to be implicated as being one of the most instrumental in some of the events that are going on right now, which I feel are really, really, it's one of the reasons, in my opinion, that we have a dysfunctional government right now. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
You would. Okay. Let me ask you another question. You know, you and I were chatting. We've got about 6 minutes left here or so. But you and I were chatting off mic about an issue that I think is really interesting. And that is, I told you that from the discussions that I've had with Josh and Charlotte over the past few years, really, that the Epoch Times is pretty much, and they certainly seem to be pretty much pro-Trump. And I posed that question to you, and you said, you know, it's not necessarily a question of being pro-Trump or anti-Trump. It's a question of reporting the news accurately. That's the mantra at the Epoch Times, and that's why I love you guys. Elaborate on that, if you would.
Thank you. I think what's happening in the media world right now, and especially leading up and after the 2016 election, is we're really seeing the true colors of the major media organizations coming out, because their grip on control is loosening, and just about everything you read from these major I would say formerly respected newspapers is tainted with bias. And, you know, we're a relatively small player when we were starting out, but the origins of the newspaper always dealt with reporting the news accurately. So we may stand out among the crowd of all the mainstream and establishment outlets as pro-Trump, but not because we are necessarily like doing political work, but we're just covering the news. But if you contrast it with the rest of what's going on, it may seem pro-Trump for sure. I'd venture to say that.
Well, I would have to say that the only reason I think that somebody would get the impression of it being pro-Trump is because you guys are open-minded. The mainstream media in my, you know, I thought the New York Times up until about 2014 till 2015 was a really fun paper to read. And then I canceled my subscription, which was, you know, living out in the sticks like I do, it was a fairly expensive subscription. I canceled it because I realized we were getting news that really didn't make a lot of sense. It was more emotional opinion than anything else. And I feel the same way, unfortunately, about the Washington Post. I guess the reason I feel that way is because the current administration is very definitely not necessarily pro anything other than the United States. And I certainly appreciate that. I think as a country, Ivan, that we truly have to do the best that we can for ourselves. And I'm saying that not to be selfish. I'm saying it because we've helped an awful lot of people over the years. And if we weren't strong, if we didn't have a strong industrial base, a strong military base, we would not have been able to do that. Now, sure, we made a lot of mistakes during that time, but you know what? We also saved a hell of a lot of lives.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Having said that, you know, I see a bit of a similarity. I know a little bit. I mentioned to you off mic that I have an undergraduate degree in Russian literature, and I learned an awful lot from Mr. Tolstoy and certainly Mr. Dostoevsky and the rest of them. And one thing I learned quite a bit about was some of the rebellions, for lack of better terms, that occurred in Russia. And if you look at the one that started just at the early part of the 20th century, around 1900, between 1900 and 1905, that culminated in the revolution in about 1917, those revolutions were really very similar, in my opinion, in their beginning as to what could eventually happen here in the United States. I really, at the risk of trying to be dramatic, Ivan, I really, really am somewhat fearful of what I would call the socialist Democrats. I don't know how far they take it. Some of their actions so far have been, I would say, number one, rude, and number two, totally inhumanitarian. Any comments on that?
Oh yeah, I would totally agree with that. I mean, any person who lived in Russia at that time that's still alive now would recognize the similarities. And I mean, they call themselves the Democratic Socialists, but really they're socialists, and really ultimately, socialism is just a preliminary stage to communism.
Yep.
What the Democratic Socialists are doing is what they've been actually doing for a long time. But what's alarming is that they're actually getting media attention, and that the young people in this country are actually aligning with their ideas, which is really terrifying. Because if you look back at history, the results that socialism gets anywhere right. Eventually turn to utter failure, brutality, and death. Mm-hmm.
I agree. Mr. Panchikov, we got to take a break here. Not take a break. We got to wrap it up. KER politics is over. I got to tell you, sir, you have become one of my go-to guests from the Epoch Times, and I certainly appreciate your help. Have a great weekend, sir.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.